The presenting sponsor of Food Safety Matters is Michigan State University. Food safety is a priority, and food safety professionals like you need the most up-to-date information on topics such as food security, food packaging, and emerging foodborne pathogens. Michigan State University offers a Master's of Science in Food Safety, 100% online, which will help you develop critical thinking, increase your understanding of food safety science, and advance your leadership skills, putting you and your company at the forefront of food safety. Visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the Master's Program link to learn more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with my co-host, Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director of the magazine. And we're also very pleased to have our Food Safety Insights partner, Bob Ferguson of Strategic Consulting, here with us to discuss his latest survey and column on how microbiology testing continues to grow. But with only some analytical methods showing growth. So, this already has me wanting to ask some questions. So I hope you're ready, Bob.
Well, don't ask questions I can't answer. Only ask the easy questions, please.
No, no softballs here, Bob.
Yeah.
No.
Not from Barbara.
No. No.
Wait, I think I hear my mom calling.
In addition to our discussion with Bob, you'll also hear Barbara's interview with Noel Anderson, managing partner of Mosaic Food Advisors and current president of the Institute of Food Technologists, aka IFT. Noel was also elected as an IFT fellow in 2010, which is a great distinction for a food scientist. So I want to make sure that we all know who we're speaking with here. Noel has and continues to enjoy a very long and interesting career in the industry, so we know you'll appreciate hearing his perspectives. And as a little aside, just at the top here, don't forget that you can attend IFT online July 19th through the 21st. So, but before we get to all those fascinating discussions, we got a little bit of news. The first is that FDA has released their list of drugs, and this is also getting a lot of play on our website too, so we figured it's important to mention to you guys. FDA has released their list of draft guidance as well as possible new topics for guidance documents that they're considering for the next year. Some of these may or may not come to final guidance. The list is offered to provide stakeholders increased transparency and additional insights into the food program's priorities. And going forward, FDA will be releasing the list of anticipated guidance topics at the beginning of each calendar year with mid-year updates. And the list that they just released will be updated by the end of January 2022. So actually, is this a little bit of a preview then? They're like, okay, we're doing this year, but next year, this is going to be happening at the beginning of the year.
Sounds like it, yeah.
That's very nice. That's appreciated. So in looking at the list that they provided, there are 25 items on the list, and we're sure that we encourage you to take a look at the list yourself to see where you may be impacted. For myself, I kind of, grouped them together. There are 8 items that are categorized as food safety, 9 under FSMA, and also included are allergens, food additives, labeling, dietary supplements, and nutrition. So
yeah, the big issue with this list is that you can't click through to see the sub-lists.
Right, so, or the guidance that may or may not be there.
Right, so FDA, we're waiting. You got to flush that out there.
I'm glad you said that, because every one of these issues I'm reading going, wow, that could really be important depending upon exactly what that is. So you do have to dig into the details to see exactly what it means.
Right, right. You're only going to get so far on the headline, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It is really fascinating that, and I think, Stacey, you said it's in alphabetical order, but to see allergens on the list, and the first one was looking at allergens other than those already defined as control allergens. So what's FDA have on their mind? Maybe nothing, but maybe some new allergens, regulated allergens coming down the pike as well.
Uh-oh, the big nine is going to...
Yeah, we might be joining the rest of the world in allergenic foods to look at celery, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Mustards?
I mean, we got sesame done, so see, that was a good
We did
thing.
Sesame. That only took like 10 years, 15 years, though, so what do you think?
So.
Yes, yeah.
So we shouldn't change anything just yet, is that what you're saying?
I don't know. I just don't get, you know, don't get everybody all ramped up, right? All right. Well, the next item is a little piece on culture. We noticed that SSAFE, or Safe Supply of Affordable Food for Everyone, in collaboration with Culture Experience, is launching a free entry-level tool to help food companies measure the, quote, people element of their food safety culture, and accelerate the development and implementation of strong food safety cultures in food businesses around the world, which kind of sounded like our audience. So I figured, well, you guys would probably like to know about this. The free tool is available in 55 languages and takes users through a series of 15 questions that only take 10 minutes. So we've all got 10 minutes. Even the busiest of us have 10 minutes, right? Upon completion by the team, managers will be able to identify key strengths and weaknesses of their food safety culture, showing them where to improve and strengthen their efforts. And the tool is effective for companies starting on their journey to assess and strengthen their food safety culture over time. So they also said there's going to be a webinar, which is happening like today when we're recording the episode. But we're hoping that that will be available on demand as well. So we're going to provide you with links in the show notes.
I'm so excited that they're doing so many different languages. That's really great.
Yeah, it's really helpful.
I was going to say, I was a little nervous about that comment because I think the last time on the podcast we mentioned something in 50 languages, we all tried to speak several of them. So I'm not
No, we won't be doing that again.
We're not going to do that? Okay.
I'm still struggling with English, so, you know.
Which is why it's good we're recording.
Yes, always helpful. Always helpful. You guys don't have to listen to the tape that hits the floor because it could be brutal. yeah, but it's always great. I mean, food safety culture is I don't know, as we've dug into it, and I'm going to talk about our culture series, but this is such a big, changing a company's culture is just huge, huge work. And changing around food safety, anyway, it's important. And so we also want to mention, as long as we're on the subject of food safety culture, we wanted to remind everyone that Food Safety Magazine, in conjunction with Lone Jesperson of Cultivate and 3M Food Safety, we've just completed our 5-part series on global food safety culture in 5 distinct regions: Europe, Australia, Asia, US and Canada, and Latin America. You can now view all 5 incredibly informative webinars on demand. And you can access those on our website at food-safety.com. Under events, you'll see webinars, and you'll find each of those webinars. They were really, really amazing.
Well, we have the podcast episode 96 with Reich Luce, and he talked about food safety culture in Africa. So we've covered even beyond. So.
Mm-hmm. Are we going to tease the fact that we're actually going to have a podcast with Lone and 3M coming up about this series? Dare we?
The crystal ball says it will happen, but that's as much detail as I can provide at this moment.
Your magic 8-ball says.
The food safety magic 8-ball. Very nice.
I need a food safety magic 8-ball.
I have a magic 8-ball.
I think Barb just turned the 8-ball over and said, please ask again later is what we got. We got that one.
I love the magic 8-ball.
Love the magic 8-ball.
Oh, my goodness.
I have one somewhere. Man. I don't know where it went.
I do, too. I need to dig that out. All right. So apparently, keep that handy for more information on our...
But I think ask again later did come up several times. So we're still working on it.
Okay, so we'll go with that. We'll go. It's coming, you guys. It really is. It's coming. All right. So as always, we're going to provide links to all the resources that we've mentioned in our show notes. You can visit your podcast page and your player or food-safety.com and then find episode 99, and we got all the links for you.
99.
Shh, 99. I know, here we are. You can hear the drums rolling.
Right? That was very good.
Anyway, I know.
That was a very good drum roll there.
Pretty good. I won't try and do it again. So, one last thing. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Search for Food Safety Magazine. Now it's time for some food safety insights from our partner, Bob Ferguson, president of Strategic Consulting, who will give us an overview of his latest food safety insights survey and column featured in the June-July issue of Food Safety Magazine.
A little nervous about having to follow the magic eight ball, though.
I know.
I was trying to find a kazoo to introduce you, Bob, but I couldn't find my kazoo either, so oh well.
Keep my comments alone until everything will get cut. I'm going to just be quiet on that one.
Then, I'll break out a recorder. Who knows where this is going to end?
Who knows?
Pan flute, right?
Okay, before this goes too far. The current Food Safety Insights is part two of our survey of 200 food processes that we conducted earlier this year. And if you recall that survey, that showed that we expected significant increases in food safety testing this year, in some areas, really large increases. That survey showed that about half of the processors who responded said that their testing is going to stay about the same. But the other half, that is all those projecting any change in volume, the number who are saying that they'll see an increase outnumbers by 5-1 those forecasting a decrease. And some of these were significant increases. So we spoke last time about this, about the increase in outsourcing that goes along with this. So some of this increase is going to be done by the processors, but some of it's going to be analyzed and be to the advantage of our food safety laboratory, commercial laboratory friends. In this part two, what we also found is that the outsourcing trend is not only affecting the test volumes, but it seems to be affecting the test types being used as well. Within this increased level of pathogen test volumes that's going to labs, we saw a much higher volume being analyzed by PCR than what we would have expected. Actually, far higher as a percentage of overall volume. So the increase is not explained just by the volume increase, but PCR is clearly taking a higher share of the increased volume. So more samples are going towards PCR and adjusting the shift of the type of analytical tools being used for pathogens. But with other technologies, we see about the same thing we've seen before. Test volumes and selection seem to be staying the same with whole genome sequencing. For the fifth year in a row, we asked about the use of whole genome sequencing, WGS, and we still see only a few processes reporting. In this survey, it was only 2% of those reported ever using whole genome sequencing even once. So that's staying the same, but PCR is increasing dramatically. There's more details about it in the article, but that's really the takeaway from what we've seen on these details.
So, Bob, you said the increase in PCR wasn't just because of the increase in volumes. Is the resolution of the test better? What do you think is responsible for the increased use of PCR?
So my answer is going to be somewhat speculative, but I believe that this is what's going on. If processes are outsourcing to labs and they're already using PCR and they say, I'm going to stop doing my own pathogen test in-house, it makes sense that they would specify to the lab to use PCR. Hmm. And so that would be a one-for-one switch. But if they're not using PCR, if they're using, let's say, immunoassay strips, or they're using some other type of test, and they send it to a lab, and they're saying, you're now my lab partner, I'm coming to you for technical help, what do you recommend? It seems to me that the labs are recommending PCR. And it makes sense that they would help drive that conversion. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is, there's nothing wrong with using PCR. It's accurate, it's accepted. Processors use it, buyers use it, so that the test match. It makes a lot of sense for people to use the same technology. The other thing, again, there's nothing wrong with this, labs operate on the basis of fixed costs and running as much volume through technologies as they can to be efficient. If they have PCR instruments and someone is saying, what should we use? And they're recommending a perfectly good PCR technology, I think that's helping to drive the conversion as well, to keep the instruments full and keep the lab full. So I think that's a big piece of this. We need to learn a little bit more about exactly how that's happening, but it seems pretty clear to me that the labs are driving some of this.
You can definitely see with the instrumentation that you can get really super high throughput thermocycling. Can you talk a little bit more about the outsourcing conversion and how it looks like U.S., North America versus the rest of the world? Is it a trend globally?
It is a trend globally, but a lot of it depends upon where you are. So North America is clearly leading the outsourcing trend. The growth here is higher than any place else. Europe is second. A little bit different. We talk about this in the article, but because of labor issues and what happens there, you can't downsize as easily in Europe. So you tend to keep the samples in-house because you're keeping people busy. The other thing is, the labor issues are different in different areas of the world, but also lab availability is different. If you're going to outsource in the United States, it's easy to find a lab. One of the things that we found in the surveys, which I found really interesting, was there are a number of the processors that report to us that come from different island nations. If they have a lab, they tend to outsource. If they don't have a lab, they don't have a choice. So you see these, what I like to call lab deserts, where they would like to outsource. They don't want to do the test in-house, but they don't have an option. That occurs throughout North America, some areas of rural Canada, rural United States, elsewhere in the world. But it tends to have to do with availability of labs and labor issues.
That's interesting. So when you're speaking of, the little desert of not having a lot of labs, it sounds like whole genome sequencing has hit a little bit of a desert in terms of utility. I wanted to pick your brain a little bit because I wonder if part of the reason that processors aren't using it, we know that costs have come down, but if you want to compare your results against a central database, you're really looking at a government agency database. And I had heard that some processors aren't comfortable with the agencies knowing that they're poking around in the database. So is that still an issue, or are there other things at play?
Yeah, I think that's a part of the issue. Processors certainly mention that. People don't quite know what's going to happen with the data or how it can be used. So from a defensive standpoint, maybe it's better not to generate the data. That's definitely an issue. I think the bigger issue, though, is keep in mind that we talk to food processors about their use, and most of them are finding that WGS, for what they do on a daily basis, just doesn't have the utility that they need. So if you picture someone at the FDA or the CDC who's investigating an outbreak and using sequencing, applications like that are certainly growing, and it's being used more and more. I think it's obvious. We see that all over the place. And for those kind of applications, it's invaluable. But in my words, if you're at a processor and your job is to get product out the door and onto trucks and delivered, what WGS offers doesn't really help you in that effort. Until something goes wrong or you have an outbreak or you have an investigation, then the tool becomes something to use. But on a daily basis, for most of your samples, for most of what you need, it's a little too much. It's a little too much. And most people are saying, I don't know what to do with all that extra information. I think that's the biggest reason.
So you think that the application is really, if you have a contamination that you don't know where it's come from, you're trying to do root cause analysis, then you can run a bunch of samples, fairly high throughput with whole genome sequencing, and maybe find your source. But that would be a special case as opposed to daily type of swabbing or something like that.
Right. So in this survey, we had four people say that they've used sequencing at some point. And it's probably a small volume, and they used it once because of exactly what you're talking about. And then they put it away until they need it later, if they ever need it later. But I think for the search and destroy type things, for the incidents, getting out harborage organisms, it's being used. Beyond that, not by processors. Now, the use of sequencing, and I don't have these numbers, but the use of sequencing is going up significantly by regulatory agencies. And I think the volume of test being sequencing is clearly growing at a high rate, just not on a daily basis by processors.
Sure. I know, Stacy, you talked about having lots of questions. I don't know if I've asked them all or if you had any burning questions that you were dying to ask.
Well, thanks for asking, Barbara, but I was just riveted in the answers, and I think my questions have been answered. Of course, I want to thank Bob for his amazing contribution, and you can all access the article on our website. We'll find a link to that in the show notes, because we love our show notes. There's a lot there. We pack in some, they pack a punch. Thanks, Bob.
Bam.
All right, now we're going to hear Barbara's discussion with Dr. Noel Anderson, managing partner of Mosaic Food Advisors, which helps startup companies in the food and beverage arena succeed in the marketplace. Previously, Noel spent 19 years in research and development at PepsiCo and 18 years at General Foods and Kraft. After receiving his bachelor's, master's, and PhD from the University of Massachusetts in Food Science and Nutrition, Noel stayed actively engaged with the Food Science Department. He served on its Industrial Advisory Board for more than 20 years, 16 of those as its chairperson, and he received the UMass Amherst Alumni Association's Distinguished Service Award in 2011. Noel is also very active in the Institute of Food Technologists, and as we mentioned, he is currently serving as the 2020-2021 president of the association and was elected an IFT Fellow in 2010. Previously, Noel served as a trustee and then chair of the Board of Trustees for Feeding Tomorrow, IFT's foundation.
I had a lot of fun speaking with him and chatting about how food science as a discipline, multidisciplinary area, I have to say, just like pharmacology as a note, side note. But it continues to evolve. Food science has evolved a lot over the years. And what that means is that food safety professionals just have a lot more added to their plate because it's expanded into nutrition and sustainability. And all of those things have to be, you know, managed. And who better than the food safety professional to do that? But it was a really interesting conversation. And like Stacy, you mentioned, the meeting is coming up, so we'll get to hear some more from him.
That's great. So after a quick break, you'll get to hear that interview. Michigan State University is leading the way in food-related education and research. But what some don't know is just how accessible a graduate degree in food safety is from this leading Big Ten institution. Michigan State University offers an MS in food safety that is 30 credit hours and taught completely online. It's designed for you, the working professional. Courses are designed to be flexible, applicable, and students can tailor their electives to include coursework in food law, packaging, or public health. This degree program will increase your depth of knowledge in food safety and will help prepare your company for any food safety challenges. Visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the master's program link to learn more.
Hi, Noel, and welcome to Food Safety Matters.
Well, thank you, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I'm excited to speak with you about the changing face of food science. So I know you've spoken in the past about how food science is changing, but maybe you can provide our listeners with a little recap of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I grew up in the academic world basically in the 1970s, graduated with my PhD in 1980, then went right into industry. So I spent 18 years working at General Foods and Kraft, and then 19 years working at PepsiCo. So I worked on many of the major brands for two or three of the largest food companies in the world and really loved doing that work. But what I found during that time is while we were always focused on making sure we delivered great tasting products that delivered decent nutrition, I think things really started to change dramatically around 2000. And this is a point in time where, I got very well exposed to Indra Nooyi at PepsiCo. And early in 2000, I think it was about 2004, 2006, she came out with her Performance with Purpose platform. And her goal was to transform PepsiCo to position it for long-term sustainable growth. The basics of that platform were threefold. Number one it's okay to have fun for you foods, because eating food should be an emotionally pleasing experience. You should have some fun eating some of your food. Unfortunately, that was the bulk of PepsiCo's portfolio back then. What she said we needed to do is improve the quality of your base products. Can you remove or reduce some of the negatives, sugar, salt, and fat? And then can you, through a series of acquisitions or developments, create platforms of products that would really be good for you? So that was the advent of them purchasing companies like Tropicana so they could get into the fresh orange juice business, and Quaker Oats so they could have Quaker oat cereal, hot oatmeal and things like that. So she really clearly saw that unless we were going to provide human sustainability, serving products that were truly good for you from a health and wellness point of view, PepsiCo was not going to be successful 5, 10, 20 years from now. So I give her a lot of credit for coming out with that. And what I've seen since then is a lot of the other major companies have done pretty much the same thing. It is no longer all about great taste. We need to deliver great taste, but with purpose, with health and wellness benefits. You know, the other interesting thing that Indra did back then is she hired an MD to make sure that everything that we're doing was grounded in sound science from a nutrition and health point of view. The other major event that took place was about 6 years ago when I was chair of Feeding Tomorrow, which is the foundation of IFT. And as a result of being on as chair of the Feeding Tomorrow, I was a member of the board of directors for IFT, and we were starting to redo our strat plan. And it really became clear to us as we sat around that room that the traditional disciplines that I had talked about before, all the sciences, the chemistries, sensory science, et cetera, are no longer enough to meet today's and tomorrow's challenges. So at IFT, we had traditionally talked about being the Institute of Food Technologists and our primary membership were food scientists. And we talked about food science, but we decided it was time that we had to talk much more about the science of food, a much broader definition of what it is and what it's going to take to make foods better meet the health and wellness needs of today's and tomorrow's consumers. So I was very happy about that change in nomenclature from food science to the science of food, because it just says to me that we need a lot more disciplines to attack and solve today's challenges. We need to understand the microbiome. We need to understand cell receptor biology from a sweetener point of view. We need to understand behavioral psychology, environmental sustainability, all those type of things that are much beyond what you're traditionally taught in a food science program. So while the bulk of my experience in industry was focused on making products look and taste great, and it was very commonly said, taste is king and deliciousness counts. But now it's becoming ever so clear that we need to deliver great taste and true health and wellness, as well as sustainability for us to be successful going forward.
Now, obviously, there has been a huge shift with food products for nutrition and health and wellness, like you mentioned. But what do you think were the initial drivers of that shift?
Well, I guess I'd suggest that, you know, health and wellness was always important to the industry in particular. And again, if you think about in the 1900s, the industry really did successfully address existing nutrient deficiencies. They were effective because they were able to add these ingredients to foods. They were stable in the foods, and they didn't have a big impact on the food's palatability. But it was also effective because, in large part, because of industry's large reach to the consumers. So if you think about things like goiter, scurvy, rickets, neural tube defects, you don't see those anymore. But then I would suggest that it became increasingly aware that the approaches taken in the mid to latter part of the 20th century weren't working. And many people believe that the Western diet was a major cause of this. So again, if you go back to the 1960s, the Framingham Heart Study played a huge focus on heart disease and implications of dietary cholesterol and saturated fats. Later that, you know, in the 1980s, 90s, obesity and diabetes were starting to increase at alarming rates. Yeah, so when I first started General Foods, my very first product was called Anytime Dessert Treats. And this was designed to be a portion-controlled 50-calorie dessert to help address some of the weight concerns going forward. So after that, I started working on fat reduction strategies. And again, this is back in 1980-81. So if you remember, the direction in the 1980s was to reduce saturated fats, and then we transitioned in the industry to use hydrogenated plant oils. Then we had to evolve from hydrogenated plant oils to partially hydrogenated plant oils due to concerns about saturated fats. Then we had to transition to no trans oils, which is a more recent change. So there's been a lot of change in how we address fats in the diet, as well as there's been a huge focus on sweeteners. So again, if you think about the high-intensity artificial sweeteners, saccharin's been around since the late 1800s. It was actually widely used in World War I due to the shortage of sugar on a global basis back then. In the mid-1900s, you had APM, ACE-K, sucralose come out. Again, high-intensity artificial sweeteners. And that was followed up by high-intensity natural sweeteners, the stevias, the monk fruit juice, and more recently, the rare sugars such as allulose. So lots of activity in the fat and sweetener space to try to replace fat and sugars to reduce calories, make products more healthy for you. Also in the 2000s, carbohydrates came more under attack, especially sugar. So it's kind of interesting when you think about it, about every food group has been under attack since the 1960s, whether it be fats, sweeteners, carbohydrates. So it's, in spite of all that great work done for the last 50 years, I don't see the situation regarding global obesity, diabetes, heart disease getting any better from the statistics I read. So to me, it's not working. And it reminds me of the Einstein quote, you know, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome is the definition of insanity.
Why do you think those changes, those dietary replacements, haven't moved us closer to, you know, the goals of health and a desire for wellness? What's missing?
So, you know, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about, I got involved in a dietary guidelines discussion that was sponsored by IFT and the University of Massachusetts about 2 weeks ago. And when you think about the dietary guidelines, it's about reducing sugar, salt, and fat. It's about moderation, but it's also about consuming a lot more whole fruits and vegetables. And when you consume more whole fruits and vegetables, you're going to dramatically increase the amount of fiber that you incorporate. So I think to make it kind of a short story, I think the bulk of the food industry doesn't play in the fruit and vegetable arena. Those are mostly fresh produce. Most of that innovation to reduce sugar, salt, and fat has been on the established brands that aren't going to have as big a potential positive impact on your diet as consumption of more fruits and vegetables. So to me, there's a big gap in innovation when it comes to using more whole fruits and vegetables in our diet going forward. And I think that would have a dramatic impact on everyone's health and wellness. I read one article on statistics about fruit and vegetables. And from a fiber point of view, it's recommended you eat 25 to 30 grams of fiber per day. Most Americans consume less than 15. From a fruit and vegetable point of view, the dietary guidelines suggest 5 to 9, 5 being the minimum. Average consumer only consumes 2.7 servings of whole fruits and vegetables today per day. So again, I think there's, to me, it's a matter about holistic diet and not enough emphasis on whole fruits and vegetables.
That's interesting. So when you go back to when you were researching dietary replacements, the fats, did you find that that had any impact on the food safety profile of the foods you were adding those replacements to?
So it's always product specific when you ask a question like that, Barbara. So typically with fats and oils, that they really don't impact the safety of a product all that much from an ingredient point of view. Really doesn't dramatically change the microbial load or the pH or any of those other things that might create hurdles to cause microbial growth and food safety issues. To me, it's much more of a stability, texture, organoleptic challenge that you face. And I think that the same could be said for sugar. We don't use sugar as a preservative as much as we used to with jams and jellies, but it does create a tremendous organoleptic difference from a food safety or from a food quality point of view.
That makes a lot of sense. So I'd like to slightly pivot to the new drivers of change in food science today. So I know there are a lot of these that have been talked about out there, but I know what GFSI, the Global Food Safety Initiative's meeting, has been talking for years about the growing world's population and being able to feed, you know, the number of people on this planet. So what impact does having to produce more food for a growing population have on food science?
So that's a really good question, Barbara. And one of the things we talked a lot about at IFT when we're going through that strat plan redo a few years ago is how are we going to help feed the 9 billion people by the year 2050? That's kind of interesting because, you know, you look at the data and everyone tends to draw a straight line plot about where it's going to end up. And that straight line plot takes you to 9 billion. More recently, I've been reading articles that maybe we're not going to get to 9 billion. The birth rate in many countries is well below that what's going to maintain their current population. Net, the population in many countries, particularly developing or developed countries, are actually going to go down. So maybe we don't need to feed 9 billion by 2050, but we're still going to have to feed more than we're feeding today. And I think science plays a key role in that. There's tremendous, tremendous amount of research being done in the space to figure out how we can produce more food. So whether it be genetic engineering to develop properties of fruits and vegetables and grains that can survive in harsher climates. There's new sources of protein from plants, algae, insects, mealworms, and even from the air, which I find absolutely amazing. And as it was kind of interesting, I came across this article by Finisterre Ventures, and they claim that in the ag tech companies arena, they received $22.3 billion of funding in 2020, $17.3 billion in food technology areas, and $5 billion in agricultural technology areas. This is a 50% CAGR over the last decade. So it tells me that there's tons of people playing in this space to create a brighter future for all of us in terms of food supply, quality of food, delivery of food, et cetera, and that the money is there to invest in these small startups at a huge number. So I tend to be extremely optimistic about the future. When the money's there, I think the ideas will further come out and be supported, and many of them will come to life to make a difference.
So you mentioned air. I have to ask, so what's all that about?
That one, Barbara, I don't know the details. It caught my attention. It was basically this organism that they found, I think, around a volcano, if I remember correctly, and I might not have this 100% correct, but it basically, that's what it does. It captures carbon dioxide and can turn it into protein.
Well, I am going to keep my eye on that because that sounds like crazy science fiction, but I'm going to be checking that out.
But it's a great example, you know, where necessity is the mother of invention. I think because there's so much emphasis on feeding the 9 billion people and environmental sustainability and all these type of big vectors going in a bad direction, all those crises, just like COVID, creates opportunities.
Right.
And I think we see a huge increase in the type and diversity of thoughts that can help attack these issues.
Sure. I agree with you. Now, you mentioned at PepsiCo, there was a focus even then on sustainability. So how does that factor into what food scientists are doing today?
So it, you know, in my 19 years at PepsiCo and the 18 years at General Foods Kraft before that, those factors are always part of what you try to balance as you're developing new products, packages, and processing. It was always good business to make sure you produce the product with the least amount of raw materials needed, that you process it with the least amount of energy and waste needed.
So you're trying to do more with less. That's always been a driver of business, right, to save costs. But now there are consumers that are really looking closely at what a company is doing in terms of leveraging resources, reusing water, a lot with climate. You know, we've seen a lot of push in that over the years too. So are those things more on the minds of, you know, food scientists today than they have been in the past?
Yeah, so they've always been top of mind to the food scientists and the food engineers. That was always part of good business, and you had to do those things for you to be a successful, sustainable business. In the early 2000s, I remember projects from PepsiCo in India where certain parts of the country, water was scarce. And they were very concerned by the amount of water that we were taking out of the aquifer and putting into our industry, industrial uses and products. So even back then, we were thinking about ways to reuse water system, the gray water, and such as the gray water that's created in the plant environment. We were collecting rainwater on the roofs and things like that, using the gray water to irrigate the property, and making sure that we use the minimal amount of water during the process to be able to produce our products. This was a huge, huge priority, again, well before it became such a popular thing that you hear about today in terms of water use and reuse.
That's interesting. I'm wondering if the same would hold true for farms where, you know, we've seen a lot of advances now. We'll see what happens with leafy greens and some of the mitigation strategies that they're going to be using. But you would think that they would err on the side of more water, just in terms of washing and rinsing produce, since at least for fresh products that don't have a kill step, that might be, you know, a major way to have an intervention for microbes.
Yeah, and again, you know, I just get so excited when I read all the articles about new developments in any of that space. So, you know, farming these type of products indoors has become a key trend. Matter of fact, most of the lettuce that I buy here in Rhode Island comes from Massachusetts, I believe, from big greenhouses where they can much better control the amount of water used, lack of pesticides, pests, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's showed to me that you can have a successful business that they've been around for quite a while now, that you can have a successful business able to deliver on those type of things.
That's great.
When I think about the farmers, you see an awful lot of work done in the sensor space. So you can monitor crops with drones and understand what stress they're going through, and then give them the targeted application of whatever is needed to keep the product or the produce in great shape. Mm-hmm. And I understand the irrigation is far beyond what it used to be 20, 30 years ago, and be able to target the right amount of water at the right place at the right time. So to me, artificial intelligence, better sensors, and the ability to monitor things in real time is going to make even more incredible progress going forward.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I've been thinking about, and maybe IFT has a position on this too, some emerging challenges that you're keeping your eyes on that, you know, as a group of food scientists or other food industry professionals listening to this, what do you recommend people keep their ear to the ground about?
So one of the things I used to say when I was working at PepsiCo is we need to be aware of what's going on outside of the four walls of PepsiCo, if you will. So part of the value to me of belonging to IFT is you get exposed to so many different areas and disciplines and trends and issues. So I think having that external focus across a wide variety of areas is absolutely critical to our success. So two things to build on that. Number one, I was reading recently that 5 out of 10 food executives expect a new pandemic within the next 5 to 10 years. That's very interesting. It certainly is a list of them, but COVID certainly seems to be by and far the worst that I remember living through. But they expect, you know, based on everything they've read, that we need to be prepared for the next pandemic, whatever that's going to be. Part of being part of IFT, I got exposed to other issues that are going on out there that I never hear people talking about. One I did get exposed to when I was working at Tropicana, it's called greening disease. So in Florida, there is a insect called a psyllid that feeds on the leaves of citrus trees. Could be orange, tangerines, lemons, limes. When, if it's infected with this bacteria, it'll inject that bacteria into the leaves. The bacteria will travel down to the root system of the plant and basically creates hardening of the arteries of the tree. The tree will die within 5 to 7 years. So this disease did not start in Florida. It came from either India or China, best knowledge. It started off in southern Florida, and within the matter of, I think, 7 to 8 years, it spread throughout Florida. It's in Texas. It's in California. It's in Brazil. It's in Mexico. There is no known cure for greening disease, and it packs a huge, important crop of all those countries I just listed. So there's lots of work going on to try to address it, but the last I knew of, there was no, other than taking a GM approach, which it was discarded early on due to the concern about consumers' reluctance to purchase GM products, that there is no known disease that I know of at this point in time. And I might be a little dated since I've been out of the industry for 3 to 4 years. But as I started doing research on that, come to find out there's very similar issues with banana wilt disease, again, a bacterial-borne issue, coconut yellowing. So those of you that had the opportunity to watch Food Evolution, you would have learned about the rainbow papaya. So the papaya industry in Hawaii was virtually totally wiped out by a fungus. And if it wasn't for the creation of a genetically modified papaya tree called the rainbow papaya, that industry would have been totally gone from Hawaii. So that was one great example of a stress, in this case, a bacterial or fungus that destroyed a crop, but a great approach to solve it, but it involved a GM product.
You know, I think back when one way that I have thought to maybe encourage people to rethink their stance about genetic engineering is if you just look at the genotype of a normal banana, not modified, just what it looks like, it is some scary looking thing. I mean, it's amazing. And you look at the name of this and go, what is that? It's like science fiction, but it's just, and that's from a, you know, science perspective, that even the normal stuff looks a little scary, that, you know, and when you mentioned about, you know, that genetic engineering is just one hammer, the fact that Mendel was breeding pea plants, that's essentially, you know, takes a lot longer to do, but it's the same type of science at work.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you talk about that, Barbara, because again, we've been modifying the genomics of plants since the beginning of mankind to try to pick the best varieties, grow, crossbreed them, and grow them going forward. I'm sure many people have seen the pictures of what corn used to look like in its early days.
Right.
It was like a grass. And now look at it today through manipulating its genetic code. Sure. And again, you know, for quite a few years, they used to treat the plant seeds with x-rays to create mutations. Then they'd grow the mutations to find out which ones had the best properties. And that's how some of the more recent crops were originally created. So we've been doing this for a very long time. I think it's how we talk about it that creates the scare factor.
Right. I agree. I think the talk that I had attended that showed the genotype of banana was just trying to make that point that it's all about how you communicate it and how you dispel myths about science. So now as we wrap up today, I'd like to give you a little bit of a platform to talk about the upcoming IFT annual meeting, but also to comment on how the association is helping drive changes in food science.
So IFT is a membership association. That it means it gets its sole source of funding through the dues of its members, and we're there to serve its members. We're not a arm of industry or government or NGOs or what have you. It's really all about the membership. As such, we try to develop programs that will further make us better, stronger, in this case, scientists or engineers or what have you. So it's all about continuous improvement, education, networking, and things like that. So to me, the Institute of Food Technologists has always been that spot that, you know, Proctor and what was the other guy, and Underwood talked about way back when, about getting people together with common interests to solve bigger problems and make a bigger change in the world. So to me, IFT is all about bringing together diverse perspectives, disciplines to help tackle big challenges and make more progress to make it a better world. Matter of fact, one of the taglines we've been playing around with more recently for IFT is better food for better lives. And I kind of really like that because I think that's at the end of the day what we're all about.
I like that too. That's great.
So we're getting ready for our annual meeting. This will be the second year in a row where it's going to be a virtual or digital event because of the COVID situation. We're very, very excited about it because the old saying, necessity is the mother of invention. You know, we've had to become very, very good at virtual type systems to help make the connections with people and really deliver great content and value to all of our members and customers. So we're very excited about what we're going to do. You can visit ift.org and it'll take you right to a place where you can learn all about FIRST. So FIRST is what we're calling the event, and it's all about food improved through science, research, and technology. So really love that tagline too in terms of FIRST, Barbara. So
now that's terrific. I love it.
You can learn all about it. And again, it's all about the science of food.
That's great. It's been such a delight to have you on the podcast today.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun, Barbara. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about some of these things that I'm passionate about.
Thanks again to Dr. Noel Anderson and Bob Ferguson for joining us on the podcast today. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. A very special thanks to our presenting sponsor, Michigan State University. Please visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the master's program link to learn more about their Master's of Science in Food Safety. You'll find links to all the references that we mentioned in the episode in your show notes. You can access those in your podcast player or on our website at food-safety.com. Hit the podcast tab in the top navigation and then find episode 99.
That was good. Hey? See?
So you didn't expect that, did you, Barbara? Yeah, I know.
Not at all.
Okay. Don't hesitate. Never, ever. Don't. Stop it. Please send us questions, suggestions, comments, random thoughts. We want to hear from you guys. To podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. And of course, you can make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your podcast player by clicking that subscribe button. And while you're there, please take a moment and rate the podcast. You know, throw some stars our way. It's good for everyone. All right, that's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on July 27th. Take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.